And we are going to be in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, we're not in John today? Nope, we're not in John today. We're in Matthew chapter 27. And I want to share this story with you out of Matthew chapter 27. It's been something that has been touching my heart. And what's interesting about this week, this is a pretty special week for us because it's Easter. And those of you that that know anything about Christianity and about Christ know that this is the day that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And so we celebrate that. We celebrate his resurrection. And so what happens is in a lot of churches, what happens is you get a lot of extra visitors. And so coming up with the Easter message is pretty important. And this is what's been on my heart. So I want to share with you Matthew chapter 27. We're going to start in verse 15. But before we get to verse 15, I want to kind of give you a little background because we're picking up a story right in the middle of a bigger story. And so you know about Jesus. He was born of a virgin. And we celebrate Christmas. He grew up in wisdom and in stature. And eventually, when he was 30 years old, his earthly ministry started. He selected 12 disciples. And we have been going through some of the things that have happened in his life. But what we see in Scripture, and specifically in the Gospels, we get a lot of attention to the last week of Jesus' life. Okay, so you got 33 years, and you get a few chapters, and then you get an extended session of what we call Passion Week. Passion Week is the week that we are just finishing. It's from Palm Sunday up through Resurrection Sunday. And so we're kind of sitting at the end of Passion Week, but a lot of things happen. The main thing is this. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the leaders of Jerusalem, of Judah, of the Jewish nation, didn't like Jesus. In fact, they didn't like him so much that they wanted to kill him. Now, there's a couple days during their calendar year that they shouldn't have killed Jesus, but at this point, they are so frustrated and they are so upset with him, they don't care what day it is, they'll take any day. In fact, they'll take the day. See, back in Jesus' day, they celebrated one day specifically, and that day is called Passover. Now, Jewish people still celebrate Passover. They still celebrate this. This is the highlight of the Jewish calendar. And what happens on Passover, and if you know kind of a little bit about the history of the Jewish people, they had a temple that they had set up, and there was different places within the temple. The outside part of the temple was called the portcullis. It was the lanai of the temple, and it didn't matter who you were, you could go through the lanai. You could go into that area. And then there was a court called the Court of the Gentiles. And if you were not Jewish, you could go into the Court of the Gentiles, but you could not go beyond that. There was a barrier, there was a wall, and you weren't allowed to go past the Court of the Gentiles. Now, the next area, and it was a little bit more sexist back then, was called the Court of the Women. If you were a Jewish woman, you were allowed to go into the lanai, the Court of the Gentiles, and up to the Court of Women, but you were not allowed to go beyond that. Okay? After the Court of the Women was the Court of Men. Okay? And a Jewish man was able to go all the way up to that point, but stopped at that point. And then we started getting into the holy places of the temple. And beyond that, there was a court of the priests, or also called the holy place. And to go into the holy place, you had to be pretty, it was a special day for you, okay? They would go in, they would do a morning sacrifice, and they would do an evening sacrifice in this holy place. But there was one person that would go in during the morning, and one person during the evening, and you had to be a part of the Levitical line to be able to do this. Now, there's estimates that in Jesus' day, there was over 150,000 men that would have been serving in this priestly position, this priestly role. So 150,000, two times a day. If you were able to go and light the sacrifice, the altar, the brazen altar, if you were able to do that once in your lifetime, you were considered fortunate. Okay? Now, remember John the Baptist, when John the Baptist was being born, his father, Zechariah, went in to do the offering, and that's where he encountered Gabriel the angel. You remember that story? That was probably the only time he was ever in that section of the temple. Okay? That was a very special day for him. Okay? Beyond the holy place is the Holy of Holies. Now, the holy place gets visited twice a day. The Holy of Holies gets visited one time a year. And it only gets visited by the high priest. Okay? So the high priest goes in there one time a year. Guess what day the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies? He goes in to make a sacrifice. He goes in during the day that we're celebrating right now, Easter. Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday. Now, during this special day, what would happen is, if you wanted your sins forgiven for the year, you would bring a three-year-old lamb, a perfect lamb that was spotless, that had no problems, and you would bring it, and you would bring it to be sacrificed. Now, this isn't like one lamb for the entire nation. You can imagine they had a gate called the sheep gate, and that sheep gate was so big, the reason, because all the lambs, all the little lambs that were coming in, all these perfect lambs that were going to be sacrificed, were being sacrificed on this day. Okay? By the way, that is the day, we call it Good Friday, that is the day that Jesus was sacrificed upon the cross. The same day those lambs were being ushered in the gate, and they were being slaughtered to take care of the sins of people, that is when Jesus was on the cross. Now, normally they wouldn't have done that. Normally they wouldn't have sacrificed a person on that day, but they were so excited to catch him, and they thought, this is our one chance, we're going to take care of it. So, they finally catch Jesus. They catch him on a Thursday night, and they try him. Remember the story? Judas betrays him with a kiss in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they bring him. And then you've got this story about Peter denying him, and all these trials and all these different things. Well, they have a trial, and they've got a problem because they are a nation that is underneath another nation. They have power, but they don't have all the power. They have Rome that lives up here, and Rome governs them. And Rome says, you can do some of your rules, but there's a couple things that you can't do. You're not allowed to kill people. You're not allowed to execute them. You're not allowed to put them to death. So if the Jewish leaders want to put Jesus to death, and they want to do it in a legal manner, they've got to get the permission of one of the governors, and there's two of them. The first one is Herod, okay? He is a governor that represents Rome. The second one is a man named Pontius Pilate. Now, Herod's title is bought. He paid for it, and not him, but his father paid for it. Pontius Pilate is a governor that is assigned by the government to take care of this region of the Jewish people. And so when we come to Matthew chapter 27, what we find is we're in the middle of this trial. Jesus has come to Pontius Pilate. The Pharisees have brought him there, the Jewish leaders, and they say, hey, look, we want this guy gone. He's causing trouble. He's having all these... And so Pilate has this conversation with Jesus, and as he has this conversation, and as this conversation goes on, what they find out is Pilate comes to this conclusion. Man, these guys are jealous of Jesus. He's really not done anything to deserve death. What has he done? He's fed people. He's taken care of people. He's healed sick people. He's done some teaching. And so we're in the middle of this conversation when we come to Matthew chapter 27, verse 15. And he is going to try to persuade the people, hey, look, I'm going to let Jesus go, and so I'm going to give you this choice. I'm going to give you a choice, and the choice is going to be between two different men. One of them I'm going to set free, one of them I'm going to punish. Okay, so look at chapter 27. We're in verse 15. It says this. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the people any one prisoner whom they wanted. At that time, they were holding a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Okay, so we're going to have a couple characters in the story today. The first one is Pontius Pilate. The second one is Barabbas. The third one is Jesus. The fourth one is a character in the sense that it's a mob. It's a group of people. It's a crowd. And the crowd wants something. And Pilate's like, well, I want to let this guy go because he is, he's not guilty of anything. And so he brings this, you see where it says notorious there? He brings a notorious prisoner. What's interesting is the word is used here in English is notorious, but it really means like a bandit or a revolutionary. This guy's, we're going to find out that he's kind of a bad dude. Okay. In fact, Mark chapter 15, verse 7 talks about him, and this is how he describes Barabbas. The man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. Okay. Now, this guy is basically, he's like a rebel, he's a murderer, he's an insurrectionist. In Jesus' day, he was known as a zealot. What we would call him today is a terrorist. Okay, you know what the zealots did? The zealots, they didn't want Rome to be over the top of them. And so what they did was they would plan attacks upon Roman soldiers to try to throw off the Roman government. And the zealots were good at being sneaky. And one of their methods of assassination was to take a knife and they would hide it beneath their robes. And they would wait until a Roman soldier would walk through a crowd of people and they would sneak up on them. They would remove the knife from their robes, they would stab them or cut them, they would kill them, they would kill the Roman soldier, they would put the knife back in and they would sneak away. Okay, now, does that sound like a terrorist?
That guy, yeah.
It sounds like a pretty bad dude, doesn't it? Now, this guy has committed murder. He has been a part of this insurrection. He's caused all of these problems. Now, what's interesting about Americans is we kind of sometimes get this this romantic notion about, you know, we talk about terrorists. A lot of times we think about like the Twin Towers and the Twin Towers falling down, and we think about those things. Sometimes some of these people kind of get this romantic image built in. Like, you know, we talk about Jesse James. You know, Jesse James was a murderer, but he kind of lives as legend in our society. We talk about pirates, and we get movies like Pirates of the Caribbean, and the bad guys, the one who rape and pillage and murder people, you know, they get kind of a good image, and the West India Trading Company, the government gets this bad image, right? Now, what I'd like to say is this, that I hope you don't get this kind of image about Barabbas that he's kind of like this revolutionary and you know, we need to admire him. I want you to think about someone that you know and someone that you love, and what if they were collateral damage to Barabbas? What if the person that you hold most dear to you was collateral damage? How would you feel about this man? You probably wouldn't feel very good about him, right? Now, the other thing that's interesting is in early manuscripts, Barabbas, his name in later manuscripts is shortened to Barabbas. In early manuscripts, he was known as Jesus Barabbas. So, Pilate's kind of doing this thing. I'm giving you two Jesus here. And you're going to choose, you want this Jesus or this Jesus? He's kind of being a little sarcastic, maybe. Now, on one hand, you got Jesus, Son of God. On the other hand, you've got Jesus Barabbas. You know what Barabbas means? It means Son of Abba. What is Abba? Father, right. So you've got Jesus, Son of Father, over here, or Son of People, maybe, Son of Father, and you got Jesus, Son of God, over here. right? That's going to be the choice that these guys are offered. Look at verse 17. In verse 17, so the people gathered together. Pilate said to them, whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? For he knew that because of envy they had handed him over. Okay, now, again, Pilate wants to free Jesus, so he gives the people the obvious choice. What are their choices? You got Jesus, the teacher. He's kind. He's gentle. He's the Son of God. He's loving. He feeds people. He does all these things. Or you've got the terrorist. Which one do you choose? Who do you want living among your women and children? The one who gives life or the one who brings terror? The one who heals or the one who's inflicting pain and sickness upon people? Okay, you see what Pilate's doing? He's trying to kind of help the people to decide. Look at verse 19. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him a message saying, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd, asked for Barabbas, and put Jesus to death. Okay? So Pilate's got this thing going on. He's got his conscience. He's got his wife. And both of them are telling him one thing. But then on the other side, he's got the chief priests and he's got the crowd. So he's trying to persuade, hey, I want to do the right thing. You help me do the right thing. Right? But you can see in verse 20 that the chief priests and the elders have a different agenda. They don't want anything to do with the Son of God. Look at verse 21 with me. But the governor said to them, which of the two do you want me to release to you? And they said, Barabbas. They said Barabbas. You know what's interesting? This is a picture of the human heart. You know, the human heart goes after the bad boy. Have you ever noticed that before? Now, it was a while ago that I was in high school, but I remember when I was in high school, I used to not only think this, but talk about this with other people in my high school. And we used to say, I had a buddy named Paul. We said, if we really wanted girlfriends, the way we would go about doing that is yelling and screaming at girls and maybe abusing them a little bit, and then we'd get girls, right? Why did we say that? Because it seemed like in our high school, all the guys that were dating someone were really mean to girls. They were rude. They were uncouth. They said things that to their face that I would have never said behind someone's back. Right? Why is it? Why is that? How come Guinevere has two choices? She's got King Arthur and she's got Lancelot. We've gone from high school to... You got the king, you've got kindness and gentleness and someone who shows affection, and on the other hand, you got this rogue guy that just kind of does whatever he wants. He's kind of James Dean, isn't he? The rebel without a cause. He's shooting and cussing and swearing and getting drunk. And why is it that the human heart goes after that? Why is it that the human heart cheers for the pirates and not for those who are protecting people? I don't know. Well, I do know. It's this little thing inside of us. We do not want authority. I remember being a young person and having parents, and my parents telling me to do something and me not wanting to do it, not because I didn't think it was good for me or not because I didn't even want to do it, but I didn't want to do it because they wanted me to. They said one and I said two. They said yes and I said no. You know that in each one of us lives this little rebel. It's our sin nature. It's this want to do what is wrong. And we didn't have to teach you that. Your parents didn't have to teach you to sin, did they? If we had two children up here, they're all downstairs, but if we had two children and I took a Snicker candy bar and I cut it so there was three quarters on one side and one quarter on the other side, and I gave one to one student and the other to the other student, what would the one say? It's not fair. And then you know what I'd say to them? But no one out here got any. Why are you looking at what? Because inside of us there's this little thing that desires. It desires to do wrong. And when we don't get something, we don't feel like we're treated fairly. Look at verse 24 with me. When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourself. And all the people said, his blood shall be on us and on our children. Now, Pilate is trying to do the right thing, and in the midst of him trying to do the right thing, there's this riot that breaks out. You know what? Have you ever been a part of a big crowd wanting to do something? You know that sometimes people, there's this thing psychologists call like this crowd mentality, that when you're a part of a crowd, there's some things that you will do when you're a part of the crowd that you would never do if you were all alone. You got people out on the street, and if you're walking by, you'd see a window, you'd never throw a brick through it. But if other people are throwing bricks through windows, you don't even know why you're throwing a brick. You don't even know what the store is about. You don't know any of that. Sometimes the crowd mentality just kind of takes over and you start chucking bricks. Right? Sometimes people get involved in stuff and they get involved in like a demonstration or a riot or something. They don't even know why they're there. I have a friend that travels the world, and he was in a foreign country and he didn't speak the language of that country, and there was a demonstration starting, and he was walking by and he said, oh, I'm gonna go find out what this is about. So he goes and stands out there in the middle of the demonstration, and he said, it was so much fun. And I said, what were you demonstrating? He said, I don't know, but we were yelling at the police, and you know, when the rocks started to fly, that's when I left. But there's something inside of us that just has that, it's that crowd mentality. We want to fit in. Even if we don't know the people around us, there's this little peer pressure. There's this little animal inside of us that wants to do what is wrong. And that's influenced by the crowd. Now, we have a number of characters, and one of those characters is a character called Pilate. And Pilate wants to do the right thing, but instead of doing the right thing, he claims no responsibility. The Bible says he got water and he washed his hands of the matter. He had the ability to do what was right, but because of the crowd, he decided, well, I'm not going to take responsibility for this. Maybe he justified it by saying, you know what, if this riot breaks out, lots of people will die. Is it going to be one man or is it going to be a lot of people? Think of all the property damage, think of all this stuff. And sometimes you and I can do that as well, where we say, well, it's not really my fault. Everybody around me was... All right, look at verse 26 with me. Then he released Barabbas for them, but after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. Now, I want to give you the rest of the story here, and I'm going to give it to you in my paraphrase. When Barabbas hands over Jesus, he actually hands him over to be scourged. If we look at other Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, what we find out is, again, Pilate's still trying to save Jesus. And so what he does is he takes him and has him scourged. Now, what does it mean to be scourged? They would take take what they call a cat of nine tails, and I want you to imagine a wooden handle, and on that wooden handle there is a there's nine separate strips of leather, and at the end of those they attach something that's sharp, like a sharp stone or a sharp piece of glass or something that will cut. And so what they would do, and if you've seen the Passion of the Christ, they gave you a kind of a good idea of what happened. But they would tie your arms and your legs, and they would tie you around a post. And then a trained professional that was trained in the art of torture would take that cat of nine tails, and he would begin, as hard as he could, he had 40 lashes that he could give. Most people, when they received 40 lashes, they died from it. But as those leather pieces with the sharp would come, they would stick into the back of the victim. And the gruesome part was not when the victim got hit, but when they were removed. Because when they removed that cat of nine tails, they would take flesh. And we have historical accounts that say that when a person was done with a scourging, that a lot of times you would be able to see their backbone. Not the outline of their backbone, but their skin was removed from their back. Now, we distance ourselves from this. I want to put it to you in a different perspective. I've got a little dog. His name is Blitz. He's a cute little thing. If we were to bring him here, and I were to take a cat of nine tails, and we were to tie him up there, and I were to begin to lay into him with that, you would riot. Not only would you riot, the press would riot. The actions that I would take on my little dog today would make national news. Because that is so gruesome and so inhumane. To do that in front of a crowd would be ridiculous. Could you imagine? Little dog with no skin? And yet Jesus, Son of God, not only did they scourge him, but Jesus had a beard, probably a nice one. In Alaska, we pride the beard, okay? They removed his beard by the fistful. They ripped it out of his face. And they took thorns. They weaved it in the shape of a crown. They embedded it into his head. And they took a rod and they beat it into his head. They mocked him. They spit on him. They would punch him in the face and say, "Prophesy for us. Tell us, who is it that punched you?" And then they took a cross, and a cross is made up of two wooden beams. There's a vertical and there's a horizontal. And a prisoner would carry the horizontal part of the cross to his own execution. So Jesus has just lost all the skin on his back, and they take this rough wooden beam and they say, "Carry this." And when he falls, they pick a man from the crowd, Simon of Cyrene, and they say, "You're going to carry this for him." And they took him to a place called Golgotha, which is known as the place of the skull. And they would attach that horizontal beam to a vertical beam that was already in place. And they took that horizontal beam and they nailed it to the vertical beam, and they would dig a pit. And that pit was about waist deep. So we're talking about 2.5 to 3 feet deep. And they would lay the prisoner upon the cross, and they would take nails, 3 nails, and the first 2 nails they would put in the prisoner's wrist. They would put it between the radius and the ulna. And the reason they you know, when you read the Bible, it talks about his hands being pierced. This is part of a hand in Greek mindset. Your arm, your forearm is a part. But they would never put it in your hand, because if you put your body weight on that, it would rip right out, and they didn't want you coming off. So they would put it in the wrist. Okay, now there's some nerves that go through there. They say when people do self-mutilation, that's one of the places they target. When you commit suicide, that's one of the places you... And there are lots of sensors there, sensory receptions, lots of pain. So they would nail your hands out, and then they would stack one foot on top of the other, and they would put a nail through your feet. Once they had that accomplished, they would stand that wooden cross up, and you can imagine getting that cross upright, a 2.5 foot drop, and a sudden stop. A lot of times when that happened, the shoulders would dislocate, and they would come out of socket. Do you know how a person dies upon a cross? They die by suffocation. And you would hang and not be able to breathe. And in order to breathe, you would have to push up on the nail through your feet to be able to get a breath of air. When a person ran out of strength, they would suffocate. Their lungs would fill with fluid, and they would die. How long did a crucifixion usually last? 5-6 days. And so you can imagine walking down the highway, and as you're on your way to Kona, you see someone on a cross on the side of the road dying. And there's a sign over their head: this man stole, this man raped somebody, this man is an insurrectionist. And it's the way that the Romans used to keep nations in line. So Jesus is hanging on a cross, and they have their most special day of the year, the day when the little lambs are about to be sacrificed. And they say, well, we got to get him off this cross because it's the day he's going to be sacrificed. And they come to break his legs. And when they come to, you know, once your legs are broken, you can't push up anymore. Right? And they break the legs of the two criminals hanging on his right and his left. But they don't break his legs, because he's already suffered too much to endure it. And the Bible says that Jesus, when he gave up the Holy Spirit, when he gave his last breath, he says, "It is finished." The governor did not believe that Jesus was dead, so they sent an executioner to check on him. They took a spear and they thrust it through his side, up into his lungs, and they said the blood and the water flowed out of him. He certainly was dead. Joseph of Arimathea was a leader, one of the Jewish leaders. He was a part of the same group that had just had Jesus executed. And he asked for the body of Jesus. He took the body, he wrapped it in cloth. A lot of times a burial, they would wrap spices in with cloth, and a lot of times they would use up to 90 pounds of cloth. Okay? And he put him in a tomb that had never been used before. Brand new tomb. They rolled a rock in front of it. They set guards outside. They sealed it with the governor's seal. And they were afraid that the disciples would come and steal the body and claim that he had risen. That was Friday. Saturday, nothing happened. On Sunday, something amazing happened. The women went to anoint the body, to add spices to it, to pay their last respects, and when they got there, the soldiers were gone and the stone was removed. And Jesus showed up. Mary saw him and said, "This is the gardener." "Where?" And she says to the gardener, "Where have you taken my Lord? Let me know. I'll go get his body and put it back." And Jesus says, "Mary." And Mary looks at him and says, "He's risen. It's Jesus." Jesus appeared to Peter, the disciples, and 500 other witnesses. You believe that? That story is the crux of life. If you believe that story, then Jesus is God. And He asked for nothing less of you than your entire life. For you to give Him everything that you have and everything that you are. If that story is not true, then all that we're doing is wasted. This whole church thing is worthless. Because everybody dies. But you don't see people coming back to life. You know that there are some parallels between Barabbas and me. There's some parallels between you and Barabbas. You know that you and I are guilty of our sin and we deserve the punishment. And Jesus is completely innocent, and yet the crowd chose the one who is innocent. You know that life isn't fair, right? We learned that at a very young age. 3/4 of the candy bar went to one child, 1/4 went to the other, and we all knew what was going to happen. Doesn't matter the child or the children, we know that one was going to say, "Unfair." Do you know that if life was fair, Jesus never would have died on a cross, and you and I would spend an eternity in hell? Because the innocent was sacrificed. The innocent was put to death. Barabbas went free and Jesus paid the price. You know, the same is true about you and I if we give our life to Jesus, that we go free, that we are set free of our guilt and our sin and our shame because Jesus paid the price. Do you know that the crowd prefers what's evil? Do you think that's changed in our day? Do you think the crowd prefers to do what's right? Do you think the crowd inspires people to do good? Do you think the crowd inspires people to choose the Son of God over the Son of Abba? You know that just like Barabbas, he was trying to overthrow authority. That you and I do the same thing. That we have authority in our life and we have a very difficult time being obedient, being submissive, doing what we are called to do. And so we rebel in so many ways. We say no. We refuse to give our heart to people. We refuse to do what is right. We complain about those in authority over us. You know, for as many things that have changed in the last 2,000 years, the human heart is still the same. And I want to ask you a question. Have you given your life to Jesus? Have you given your life to Jesus? Have you said to Him, with all I am and that all I have, I will follow You? I know that I've sinned. I know that You died for my sin. And I call upon You to be the Lord and the boss of my life. Or are you like the crowd? We want Barabbas. We would rather put to death in our life all that is good and all that is well and all that God has blessed us with. Will you bow your head and close your eyes with me? Maybe you are here today and you are ready to give your life to Jesus Christ. If that's you, in the quietness of your own heart, I'm not asking you to say a prayer. I know that some of you have prayed before. You know how you can tell if you're following Jesus? Your life looks like it. I'm not asking you to say some words. I'm not asking you to pray. I'm asking you to make a commitment with all that you have and all that you are. You can say these words with your mouth or in your mind or whatever, and they can mean nothing. It's not until we truly give all that we have and all that we are to Jesus that we become His children. So if you're there at this point and you're ready to pray to receive Jesus, please pray in the quietness of your own heart. Words that go something like this. Dear God, I admit that I'm a sinner. I admit that I have done things that are wrong and that are against You. I admit I'm powerless to control my own tendencies to do wrong. That my life is completely unmanageable. Father, I give all that I have and all that I am to You. From this day forward, You make all the decisions in my life. And I follow You humbly and obediently. And I fall upon You when I do wrong. I thank You, praise You.